Hi, Zoomers. Hi, everybody. My name's Will. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Will.
It's really good to be here tonight. You have no idea how great it is to be here. Number one, you guys live in God's country. And that ride up 33 and 231 is always a treat. And I got to ride up with my friend Josh tonight. And I want to thank Billy for asking me to come up here. I have known Billy since he was about 9 minutes sober. And he used to vibrate. He used to be able to warm the room with his very presence because he just like this all the time. And it's radioactive, and we've always loved him. And he's still a very bad case, so we try to be very nice to him. As I said, I am an alcoholic, and I'm an alcoholic of what they call the hopeless variety. And I remember when I was 19, I was exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time. I was in a fancy schmancy treatment center out in Wickenburg, Arizona. And they gave you a big book, cost $25,000 or something. And I read that thing, and it, you know, and without the benefit of sponsorship or whatever, I was sitting there and I was disposed to see some stuff that I hadn't seen before. My mother, by the way, was an alcoholic by her own admission, and she was a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous up until her death. She got sober before I ever drank. And so I'm sitting there in treatment, and I'm reading the first few chapters. I'm reading Bill's story and the solution and stuff like that. The first few chapters where they're talking about, you know, the travails that we go through, and I'm really relating to it in a pretty big way. And I'm actually very relieved to know that at the age of 19, that I beat my mother in here by like 20 years. You know, in age, she got here when she was like 47. I was turning 20 that December. This was like November of 1984. And I had drunk my way out of this Thomas Jefferson's University down here, University of Virginia, which was not the plan. It was not the plan. And I came out of there, and I was very, very happy to get off the plane. It was an AA plane, by the way, American Airlines. And I took the little... what was it? The little trays they bring around, and they have a little sheet over it. You know, they gave you real silverware in those days. Remember that? And I kept that because I thought it was just so miraculous that I was on AA Airlines. And I said, it must be God's will. And I got off the plane, and I had a little dinner with my parents that night. And off I went with my mother to her home group at the Congregational Church in Manhasset, Long Island, New York, where I grew up. And that was where I spent my first 19 years of life. It was idyllic. It was a little bit of Beaver Cleaver land in the midst of the tri-state area where people throw your pound of Virginia ham at you and say, next. You know, I later found out there are other civilized places. One of them was Charlottesville, Virginia, where you were kind enough to dismiss me after I could no longer keep up with my academic rigor. So I came out of there, and I went to my mother's meeting, and I met a very nice man named Jimmy Gill, who was just older than dirt. He was like 57 or something. And he was just the smiling Irishman. He was just very happy to be there. He was very happy to meet me. He was friends with my mom, and everything was cool. And, you know, I basically, my mother had sort of set him up to meet me so that maybe he might sponsor me. I think that was sort of the plan. And I kind of got that. But I thought, what's this old guy going to talk to me about? I don't talk to old guys. I talk to like people my own age. Now, I hadn't talked to anybody my own age or anybody else in any kind of meaningful sense my whole life. You know, so it, obviously I'm the kind of alcoholic who's, and I didn't know this at the time, whose ego after a period away from alcohol and wanting to be sober will rebuild itself so quickly. It's like I think Bob Azanz talks about it. It's just like, you know, my alcohol is my drinking gets tamped down, and then my ego goes three blocks north and pops up in a little weed called, you know, gambling, or you don't know what you're talking about, or you're pretty and I want you, or I need that job, you know, or give me $5,000, you know, because it's all about me and what I want. And that's really kind of what's always been wrong with me from the time that I can remember I kind of stayed 2 years old, where if I wasn't getting my way, it was just like, and I'm always looking for a way to fill that thing inside of me. And I think Ken Burns just recently put out that that American Revolution thing. So we've been hearing a lot of that phrase, the pursuit of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I always saw happiness as getting my way. If I get my way, then I'll be happy, right? And so Christmas comes and I'm happy because, you know, I'm the only child of two lovely people and I get a lot of what I want and I get all of what I need. I mean, there wasn't anything in this world that I was denied that was necessary and proper for a good childhood. I had a good childhood. The problem was is that they were raising a defective child. All right. And they didn't know that and I didn't know that. But I always felt like Paul next door, like he knew what was going on and he was loved, but somehow I was on the outside and I was not really worth knowing somehow. And that came on, that those ideas in me kind of came on probably when I was 5 or 6 years old, when I was old enough to sort of look around outside of my own, you know, toy box, if you will, and look around and start to be sort of frustrated with what's going on, and looking to get some relief from that sense of fear, which I didn't know was fear. I couldn't say any of these things. I was five, you know. But if I'd been able to say it, it probably would have been on sandwich boards. You've been to a city where, you know, the back in the day, you'd have some guy on the street saying it, on one side says, "Repent now," and on the other side says the end is nigh, you know. Repent, you know. And you know, it looks like John the Baptist, he's all dirty and blah, 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 blah. Well, mine would have said, "Look what they've done to me." And I would have told you, "Look what they've done to me." But I couldn't really say that because I absolutely knew that I was taken care of. And a lot of the time, I felt like I was taken care of, except when I didn't feel like I was taken care of. And then it was really urgent that I get back to that place of feeling like I'm taken care of. And I won't read it tonight. Maybe next time I come back up here, if you let me. But I have a couple of letters that were written a very long time ago, one by Mrs. Bohm and another by Sophie Lazar, who were my two kindergarten teachers. I flunked block, so I had to do 2 years of kindergarten. And they talk about how, you know, Billy needs to stop using his fist. I was Billy. Billy stopped needs to stop using his fists, and he's doing a little bit better. But you know, and if he works that out, you know, he'll be better. So I was already restless, irritable, and discontented. Our book talks about how, you know, unless I can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which when I was 12 years old, I experienced by having a few drinks. And when I was 12 years old, that's all that I needed. When I was 12 years old, having been given all the opportunities to flourish, I found the one thing that made me feel like I was really flourishing. And it was three shots of vodka right off my dad's liquor cabinet, right? And that was the night that Susan Buckley had not only graduated Fordham Law School up in Bronx, but had passed the New York State bar exam. So it was Irish Catholic, 10 kegs. Everybody came and drank their butts off. They drank so much that the septic system caved in. And so they had to come next door to use our bathrooms. So I'm leading people in and out of the house. And I notice what I always notice with grownups is that they're very, very happy when they're drinking. And I want to see what that's like now. So that's what I did. I had three shots of vodka and I understood why people feel that good. Later on, I'd find out why I feel so much better than most people who drink that stuff. I feel way better than most people out there who drink beer or vodka or wine. I go from zero to cruising altitude just like that, and my problems are solved. Alcohol is no problem for me at 12. Alcohol enables me to go down the street on my Schwinn Typhoon and run circles around John Palachek who is the neighborhood bully, and I would never get near him. I didn't even want to see him when I went and visited my friend Chris on any given day, you know, because he was mean and he was tough, and I didn't want the conflict, you know. And I literally ran circles around him on my bicycle, hooting and hollering like it was no big deal. And then I got Chris's little sister, who was a year younger than I was, so she was 11. I said, "Susie, quit, get on your bicycle. I got to show you something." And I took her to Manhasset Woods, and we made out. So I had my first sexual experience that night. That was amazing. And she was okay with that. I think she was probably a little taken aback, but we were there for like 2 hours, like sucking face. Really weird. But it was like, so I'm totally unafraid of the neighborhood bully, and girls like me. My problems are solved. Now, did I drink every day so that I could get through, you know, sixth grade math? No. I understood that's going to win. But, you know, three shots of vodka, that was enough. And I went to bed before the sun went down. This is like June. So in New York, in June, the sun goes to bed like 11 o'clock. So, you know, I'm going to bed before the sun goes down. I'm perfectly happy just laying down and watching the high speed whirlies with the clock, you know, next to me. And I'm just totally fine. And I woke up and I was fine. There's nothing wrong. Right. We're going to do that again. And that was my first drinking experience. It was the first time that alcohol had an effect on me. Well, that previous year, so this is seventh grade. The previous year, I won the speech contest. I actually went to my father the night before I was supposed to give the qualifying speech so that we could all vote within our classes about who was going to go give the speeches in the speech contest. There was two from each class, or four from each class. So I actually asked my father for help. I think that's the last time I asked anybody for help on really anything that wasn't immediately tangible, like $5,000, right? So my dad helped me with that, and I won the speech contest that year. It was actually a very good speech. I was very proud of that. The next year, because I'd started getting loaded, I had Mrs. Buck that year. I was a little bit nervous about that. And I didn't ask my father for help. And I really didn't know what to talk about. And I really didn't care, to be perfectly honest with you, once alcohol started entering my life, you know, how my academics were going to go. I just assumed that I'd do well because, you know, I can think on my feet pretty well. And I can take tests and all this kind of stuff. But I didn't really care about the speech contest. That's like extra. So I got loaded before school. And I'm like up there going, da, 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 da. Nobody's suspecting that I'm loaded, I don't think. But I remember sitting down after that going, this is not like last year at all. And I know why, because I'm not prepared. And I know why I'm not prepared, because I got loaded and I didn't care. And I didn't care because all I care about is getting loaded. And this needs to stop, and it needs to stop soon. Now, I didn't say it needed to stop now. I was thinking, you know, in a few weeks, you know, I need to stop. I was trying to stop drinking in the seventh grade, folks. I understood that I may end up in Alcoholics Anonymous like my mom, you know, if I don't stop doing what I'm doing. And I got here when I was 28. That was when I was 12, 13 years old. So, you know, it took me 15 more years to decide that I'm powerless over alcohol. But in the meantime, you know, alcohol is still a solution. Yeah. I'm going to fast forward a little bit because I want to get to some recovery, and I want to end early tonight. We talked a lot in the car up here, so I feel like I'm kind of talked out. But those of you who know me know that I can go for 3 or 4 hours in this terrific talk that I'm giving. But what I'm trying to do is to offer you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. Not what it was like. I don't know what it is. I don't even know what I'm like unless you tell me. I need to be involved with people. And I'm only capable in my drinking years being involved with people when I got just the right amount of stuff on board. That usually means four or five shots later on, and I know we have a singleness of purpose, but I discovered some accessories too that would enable that sense of ease and comfort to last for 3 or 4 days. I love that stuff. By itself, I don't like hearing the air around my head after about half an hour if I just snort cocaine. But if you add whiskey to it, I can balance that and just keep playing guitar with you until you drop. Okay, that's what I like to do. So for 15 years, I tried to drink and be happy and successful. But basically, what I did was I lowered my standards of performance to the place where I bottomed out at 28. And bottoming out was described by a guy who came from California to my home group in Las Vegas, Nevada, at the time, 2004. And he never finished the seventh grade. And he described bottoming out the best way I've ever heard it. You know what it is? It's when my life gets crappy faster than I can lower my own standards. Now that kind of levels the playing field, doesn't it? Some people in Hollywood might come in behind burnt toast or, I broke a nail. I must have a problem. I must go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Other people are picking up cigarette butts on Paradise Road in Las Vegas, Nevada, and they go into detox. And they could both meet at the Thai club that night in the same meeting and get sober together. That's pretty cool. But I'm not going to come here and do what you ask and do what you've done, no matter how good your stories are. And my mother had a great story of recovery, by the way. Until I'm absolutely convinced that alcohol has beaten the crap out of me to the point where I literally cannot move in any direction. And my life got just more and more miserable every year that I drank. Now, I had some great times. Make no mistake, because I was pursuing happiness. And the problem with pursuing the happiness that I understand is that sometimes I get it. I actually attain that happiness for about, what's Cliff Roach, 8 minutes? 8 minutes. 8 minutes is good. I'll sell my life out for 8 minutes. I will work really hard to get to that place where everything is okay for 8 minutes. And then chase it for another three weeks till I get another 8 minutes. That's how my drinking looked when I was 28 years old. It wasn't partying anymore. It wasn't following the Grateful Dead and dating hippie chicks. It was all about just trying to survive without you knowing that I'm a total fraud. Because I'm a total fraud. The worst part was is that I had the opportunity and I just threw it away. I've met people who have had to come from nothing and build themselves up in sobriety and make amends 50 cents at a time for like 30 years and stuff like that. That's not my story. My story is I can't look you in the eye unless I've had some kind of weird, spiritual experience that you're talking about here. And when I met Jimmy Gill when I was 19, 20 years old, that looked like something that I needed to do myself. Because self-reliance should work, because that's what I see you guys doing. That's what I see you guys doing. It looks like you're picking yourself up by your bootstraps and doing the stuff that's about life, like getting a job and keeping the job. Going to work and staying at work and getting paid and being self-supporting and all that stuff. I couldn't do any of that, not for very long. I could get the job and then I would do the job and then I'd blow the job because you people clearly don't know how to run this business because I am that stupid. Okay. So, on the one hand, like Bill in our book, he talks about how I, the best, constructions of philosophic thought are derived from alcohol. I couldn't get there anymore. I couldn't get there anymore. I'm basically alone in my drinking in the last month, in the last mile. So what's my problem? Clearly drinking is getting in the way of a lot of stuff. It's a big symptom of my problem. But when I moved to Richmond in 1993, it was my last geographic drinking. And I really wanted to go to school. My buddy Sean, who's still looking for, he's on day 41, by the way. That's a whole other story. But he came down to Richmond and he was dating a nice gal and he was getting his teaching certification. And I'm just like, that's what I'm gonna do. Because we went to really good schools, right? I went to a fancy prep school up in New England. I drank my way out of the University of Virginia, but I still have, a couple brain cells left. They're waving goodbye to each other, but I still have a and so I come down here. I'm gonna be a teacher. I'm gonna be like Bill talks about in the book. I had the same idea that Bill did. He talked about how when he got to Wall Street, started making some money, I had arrived. Well, if I go back to school, I can be a teacher and I can be like those people who taught me, and I really respected those people. I just loved the teachers that I had growing up. I had crazy people that were like John Birchers, and then we had the Trotskyites over here, and everybody in between. And we had Socratic dialogue, and we had great classes, and we learned a lot, and we had, it was a great cauldron. It was like Lord of the Flies in the school that I went to, but it was structured, and it was like I knew why I was there. And then I'm 18 and I go off to college and it's like blah, drink, and like all the stuff goes away and I don't know what to do with myself. And I just turned in on myself. The freedom to do whatever I wanted made me close in on myself because I don't know what to do with me. I need structure. And I wasn't part of the structure anymore. My parents weren't there. I just had these people, and I'm always going to gravitate to the easiest, softest way. I'm going to find the people who are like me, and that means I'm going to be drinking. And I meant to go to class every day, and I couldn't do it, And I drank my way out of there, and I go to treatment, and I come home, and I live with my parents. I had this little job at a bank, and then they're like, "You're still drinking." And I'm like, "No, I'm not." They're like, "Yes, you are. And you're going to treatment." I was like, "No, I'm not." And they're like, "Well, you either go to treatment or you're leaving the house." And I was 20 years old, and I was like, "Okay, I'll go to treatment because I don't know if I can live on my own yet, And then I escaped from there and went to Richmond to see the dead and did the tour, came back. They were like, "Okay, all right, enough of that." And then I'm like, "I guess I can be on my own." I came down to Charlottesville and I delivered pizza and tried to live that way, and watching all the guys that my fraternity brothers graduating, as I'm delivering pizza and living up to my potential and all that. And these are the days where I'm starting to close in on myself. And I'm 28 years old and I'm in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and I can't do any of the jobs that I was hired to do. My last best job drinking was as a lobbyist for Greenpeace in Washington, D.C. I was wanted to cut my hair, and because I had a good gift of gab, they sent me down as a lobbyist to work on certain environmental bills. And I was sitting there on Capitol Hill. I was talking with congressmen. I went to the Mayflower Hotel and talked with the congressman from the main line of Philadelphia, representing like 1.5 million people there. He'd been in Congress forever. And they put me on a luncheon with this guy so that I could persuade him to, his vote on this bill that we were working on. But see, I need to prepare for that. How do you prepare for something like that? You have three glasses of Chardonnay, which you do. And I had a little bit too much of me in me that day. And basically, I insulted him by saying, I got 6,000 soccer moms in the main line that say that if you don't sign this bill, they're not going to vote for you. That's not really a good way to lobby. I was summarily fired that day from the organization that I believe so much in, as a post-adolescent tree hugger. And I went back to Philadelphia. And now it's just about drinking. And it's about drinking all the time. And I came down to Richmond. And now I'm going to be goodbye, Mr. Chips. I'm going to be the I have arrived guy. And I'm going to be at the head of vast enterprises like you. I'm going to be able to teach you the classics. I'll teach you Aristotle. I'll teach you Shakespeare. I'll teach you Aeschylus. I'll teach you whatever. It's going to be great, and you're going to love me for it. And I made it through summer school. But I'm really lonely. Sean and his girlfriend had a big fat heroin habit, which I didn't know when I got there. And one night on September 18th, 1993, it was 10:30 on a Saturday night. I had been in the library all day because I'd smoked crack the previous Monday. And what do you do after you smoke crack? You got to drink two bottles of Ernest and Julio's Finest, right? Immediately. Brah. And I felt really bad meeting the Witch of Eastwick that next Tuesday morning at 8 o'clock with the sweats going down. And I hadn't done that before. I've been able to keep it down this time. I've been able to keep my drinking down a little bit. So all week I was sort of down in the mouth, and I was in the library all day Saturday. And what do you do if you're a damn Yankee in the holy city of Richmond, Virginia, right? And you don't have any friends, and you have $10 in your pocket, and you've been in the library all day. Well, I didn't really want to drink, but not wanting to take a drink never kept me from taking one. I run into a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous when they're new, and it's like, don't feel like taking a drink today. I understand that. And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and lasted 6 weeks after that first treatment center, every day I didn't want to take a drink either. I have you to look forward to. You're fantastic. I love this fellowship. But I have an illness that says, you've been sober long enough. I have an illness that says, drinking is like breathing. And I can only hold my breath so long before I realize that I need another breath. And so I'd been holding my breath all day long for 8 hours in the library, trying to get that mojo back, that enthusiasm to become Goodbye, Mr. Chips, to become the great scholar, the great guy, right? And two fingers left in a bottle at 10:30 on a Saturday night with no blue lights flashing. No consequences from my parents, nobody around to give me crap about my drinking. I was given a moment of grace. And this is why I'm here, because it took me 20 minutes to find the number for Alcoholics Anonymous. The guy answered the phone. He says, my name's Chuck. How can I help you? I said, is this AA? He says, well, I'm a member of AA. Good answer. He doesn't speak for AA. He says, I'm a member of AA. I said, where are the meetings? He said, there's one at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning. Would you like somebody to come by and pick you up? I said, where is it? It's Stewart Circle Hospital. I know where that is. It's like a 5 minute bike ride, that bicycle down the street. I said, I can make that. Now, what I heard was a number of things. It all just sort of coalesced. My membership in AA started that night before I even went to that meeting. Because A, I wanted to be like Chuck when I got sober, because he was there for me. B, before I even asked, I didn't want to be like drinking and dialing. Hey, I have a terrible day. Blah, 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 blah. I just, bam, primary purpose. I need to be here. How do I get there? Boom. And I got to that meeting and I picked up a white chip and I never left you. And I've not been tempted to drink or use any mind-altering substance since the 19th day of September 1993. And by the grace of God, and the power of God, which the steps, the program unleashes, that's been possible because I can't do that on my own. I went to AA like three, four times. First was after that treatment center, a couple more times, once in Charlottesville, another time in Philadelphia. And I lasted 6 weeks on all three of those occasions. That's as long as I can stay sober on going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with no sponsor and no steps. What I found out later is that these are the steps we took. These are the steps we took. They're not the steps that we talked about and read about and, parsed the words about choice, not choice, blah, 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 blah. Book studies are great, but what I need to do is have an experience. And I started to have an experience here that was meaningful, like alcohol was when it worked when I was 12. That was a meaningful experience. I needed something bigger than that. And I knew it. And I was able to hear you. Now, I cut my teeth on a fellowship that did everything except what's in this book. If there were people around doing that, I don't know where they were. And I certainly didn't have a sponsor that did that. So when I got to inventory at 5 months of sobriety, I did it exactly like on page 65. I resent Billy. He stole $20. It's a clear seven bagger. You know, I'm affected. And that's all that I did, was write a resentment list. No fear, no sex conduct, no conduct, period, no accountability. But you know what? It was wild. Because I was trying, I actually had some of those promises that they talk about in the book come true as the result of coming as clean as I knew how to with my sponsor. He didn't say, wipe off the chair and get out of my architecture office. He said, I'm glad that you told me about this. Now, that's all that he knew to do. So I'm not surprised that he drank shortly thereafter, because that's all he knew how to do, was take page 65 and write out a grudge list and tell a sponsor. There was no accountability there. And anyway, I'm not bad mouthing anything, but that was my experience for like the first 3 years. I'd had no idea what the hell was going on. And then I finally got with a sponsor after, you know, a couple of failed relationships, because I'm just dry as a dog turd in the desert, excuse my French, you know. And I got with a guy, and we were talking about his name's Paige down in North Carolina, and he started straight me out, you know. And I did all the steps. I started with Paige, did everything, did another inventory, blah, 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 blah. I had done a whole bunch of inventories, but see, my problem is my ego, he will even use the steps to try to manage my life. I never heard that until I heard Gary Brown talk about that a few years ago. It's like he was a 20 year sober, revered in Alcoholics Anonymous, sponsored a bunch of guys, and being sponsored by one of the biggies, Don Pritz. And he's 20 years sober, and he realizes he's trying to use the steps to manage his life, not the design. My story is this. I got busy real quick here. I love the fellowship. I got busy in service. I was a GSR at 3 months in my home group. And that wasn't because I was great. It's because everybody else had had a turn at it. And they were all old, like they were in their 40s or something. And it was my turn. And I kept showing up to the business meetings. I was just like, whatever you're doing, I just want to do. So I just knew that it was an excuse to send me away for 2 weekends, a month. Anyway, really, that is. But in that, I experienced a lot of love of Alcoholics Anonymous by being in general service. I would go to assemblies where we just beat the crap out of each other with minutia. And it's like, what are we doing here? And then we'd all hug on Sunday morning. I mean, it was weird, man. But we got the job done. And sometimes we'd actually get business done. And it was okay. The first assembly I went to was in Rutgersville. And my friend Kenneth Campbell, who was the roommate of my soon-to-be fiance, which was a completely, by the way, inappropriate relationship, and it didn't last. Thank God she dodged a bullet. But Kenneth Campbell was just the sweetest guy. He had like 17 years sober when I got here. He was really old too. He was like 57. He was like Jimmy Gilday. And he drove all the way to Charlottesville on Saturday afternoon to see how I was doing up at the Holiday Inn in Rutgersville. That's where I first went into Walmart, by the way. I didn't know the Walmart existed. That was 1994. He drove all the way to Charlottesville just to see that I wasn't being eaten by wolves at 5 months of sobriety. That's good AA. I didn't ask for that. He didn't even say, mind if I come on up? He just showed up for no other reason than that. And I was like, yeah, I'm okay. And we just kind of like leaned on each other a little bit, because he must have been having a bad week. He was a guy who really suffered a lot. You know, he was prone to depression. He was depressive. I kind of go in that. I have a very high affect. I'm either like, woohoo, or I'm like, oh, you know, being in Alcoholics Anonymous and being engaged in Alcoholics Anonymous really gets my blood up. It's a spiritual program. It's a spiritual dynamic in our fellowship. And when I'm involved in doing that with you and aspiring to do that, I'm okay. But the minute I start going back into my little plans and designs like Bill talks about, I can get real small, real fast. And then I try to make myself look big, which is just the worst recipe. But he came up and did that. And I'll never forget that. And I stayed in general service basically for the first 10 years of my sobriety. I don't think that I was particularly surrendered to a God that I could really, that I knew was there. As I said, my ego can rebuild itself very quickly. And the first few years in Alcoholics Anonymous, it certainly had room to grow because I wasn't being sponsored the way so many of us are sponsored now, where we, it's like, are you really done? Yeah, you look like you're done. Okay, let's go through the steps now. It's like triage AA, where it's just like, you done? You think this is going to work for you? Okay, step two, that's good. You want to do this? You willing? Okay, here's two number two pencils and a yellow legal pad. Get writing. Here's how to write that. And then a week later, you're in inventory. And a week later after that, you've got an eight-step list. And we're not wasting time here. In those days, I was like going to meetings trying to figure stuff out. What does that guy mean by that? What's that little nugget of wisdom? That sounded real good. And then I'd go over there and parrot it and try to sound good because it's all about how I look, and all this crap, And I don't understand why I'm so crunchy and crazy. And then I get with Paige and I start getting straightened out. And he's like, there are too many women in your bed, Will. And it's like, no, there aren't. Got a few more, you might as well send them over because I need to be validated. And it was all about that. It was all about money, property, prestige, and looking good. And that's really exhausting. After a while, it gets really exhausting trying to do that. And I know that I'm a fraud because spiritually, this is a spiritual thing. And I'm living of the world. I mean, I've sat with dozens of people in the last few years who are literally dying in a hospital bed or in hospice or whatever. And they're better off than I was in those days because they know that they're not of the world so much anymore. They need to be, they are still in the world, but they know that they're going someplace else, And I don't know when I'm going to go someplace else, but I want to spend better time doing what it appears that you do, but I couldn't seem to get there. I was just like 2 inches from the lake, dying of thirst. I can't surrender. And that made me feel even worse. I know what this is and I can't do it. And I was so frustrated. I've taken the inventories and I can tell you that self-knowledge will not fix it. We have 12 steps and you're not five. And I want these character defects removed more than anything, but I want them removed for the wrong reasons. I want them removed for the same reason that I drank, for the same reason that I did everything in my life, so that you like me. Because if you don't like me, then I'm not worth anything. So all of my life, everything has to come from outside of me in order to fill me up. And I'm still relying on human power. And I'm using the steps to do it, not the design. But I'll tell you, God uses what's at hand. When my life gets crappy faster than I can lower my own standards, that can happen in sobriety too. And if you're here long enough, you're going to probably experience that to one degree or another. Because it's not an uphill trajectory from down and out alcoholic stinky poo to, nirvana. It's more like life in all of its forms. And God evidently does use what's at hand. So when I'm working with a new guy, I'm step 12 now. When I'm working with a new guy, as so many have worked with me, I'm going to give him the promises. I'm going to tell him about that, but I'm also going to give him the warnings. And I've got enough warnings to scare the crap out of you so that you can experience the promises a little bit quicker, it turns out. Isn't that kind of nice? It says in the family afterward, we can avoid death and misery for others. So, depending upon the problem, I can give you a warning about from my experience, because that's all we have, by the way, from my experience about how this thing that you have started to do or who have or you have done it doesn't work. we can meet on that level too. It isn't just about identification from drinking. It's about identification with everything. I like that you read from page 29 of our book because it's a nice reminder of why I'm here. Our stories are about how we made conscious contact with God, because what I need is power. I had to realize that I'm not just powerless over alcohol. I'm powerless over all the stuff that I think I want, think I need, and all that stuff. And I just need to set it aside. But I won't do it voluntarily because I always have an idea. Because I'm a thinker. I'm not smart, but I have a lot of ideas and they need to be jettisoned. Some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas and the result was nil until we let go. That's what they're talking about. This happens in sobriety. It happens to me and it may happen to you. And so I will give you the promises, which are wonderful, but I also can give you the warnings. And I'm not going to do it in 45 minutes. But we will be trudging this road one to another together, and we will find each other as we need it. I believe that we will find everything that we need if we seek God. However you conceive that power, you will find that. I did. In my darkest days, when I thought that I was too sick for this program, too stupid for this program, too sinful, too defective, to whatever, to surrender, to have what you had, that's when God could actually do something with me. Because at 17 years, I threw up my hands, and after I could do everything that I could possibly do to make my life okay, and having come out of a period of more trouble than I could possibly have ever conceived of, both spiritually and materially. I had a sponsor. Alex was still sponsoring me at the time, but I had also gotten involved with the church. And I'm not here to proselytize, but again, God uses what's at hand, so whatever. And I went to confession, and Monsignor Lane, some of you may know, he's just a really sweet guy, and I basically brought my 10 steps to him because I didn't feel like I could trust my sponsors in AA with the stuff that was currently going on in my mind. This was a big problem in my life. I had so much pride that I thought that I should be able to handle the stuff and the feelings and the thoughts in my head. I don't want to call up Alex and tell him what I'm thinking. He's going to be like, "What's the matter with you?" Meanwhile, I'm getting calls from sponsees telling me exactly the same thing that I would tell Alex. And I'm just laughing with them and we're having a chuckle about it. But somehow my case is different. Why is that? I don't know. But that's a tough place to be. That's a tough place to be. But I could bring it to Monsignor Lane because everything's under seal in the Catholic Church. He's not going to bring it to anybody. I know that. And so I'm basically bringing him the stuff. The 10th step. This is the stuff. I did this. I failed to do that. I'm thinking this. I'm lusting after this. This is way too important. This is not as important. And this is my week. And I did that 3 weeks in a row. And on the third week, he said, "Well, this is the same stuff you brought me the previous 2 weeks." I said, "I know." So he's just like, "Well, let me ask you something." He said, "Do you actually have hope?" Nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous ever asked me that question. I thought that I should have it because I took the second step. And what's the principle behind step two? Hope. Yes, I have hope.
"No, I don't, but I'm not going to tell you."
Because I'm in AA and I'm supposed to be like Mr. AA and I'm 17 years sober. What's the matter with me? Don't let them know. Right? I said, "Well, since I'm in confession, Monsignor, I may as well confess. No, I don't have hope." He says, "I know. That's why I asked the question." He said, "You can go through the rest of your list. I've heard it all before. And I'll give you absolution because I know that you're really sorry." Who wouldn't be, right? "But I'm going to give you your penance. For your penance, you're not going to read Ephesians and do three Hail Marys. You're going to ask for hope. You're going to pray for hope." I said, "I got something else I need to confess." He says, "What's that?" He said, "I am resistant to pray for the one thing that you and God and I all know that I need." I didn't think I deserved any of this. I was stuck in that place, and he knew which questions to ask and what to do in me. God uses what's in him. And so I left the confessional, and I didn't go out into the pews and ask for hope. It was 3 days later, and I was boiling a pot of linguine. And I thought, Monsignor Lane loves me. I know that God loves me intellectually. I know that. But I don't feel it. I feel it when I'm in church, but not when I'm outside the building. I can sing the hymns and be in the choir and do all the stuff and help run Caritas. Thank you, Josh. And but then I lose it. It just goes away. And but I know Monsignor Lane loves me. And I know somehow I'm loved, but I'm not in touch with that. I can't access. And I can't seem to love you because I'm so scared of everything all the time. I'm so raw from this whole thing that's gone on. And I can't surrender. And I got on my knees. And I'm going to just do this for Monsignor Lane because he asked me to. And he's a nice man. And I said, if you got some of that Hopi crap, you want to send that down here? That'd be real good. And I said it just like that. And that was the most honest prayer I'd ever said in my whole life. And as I said it, I could feel the whole world just coming off my shoulders. Everything that I'd ever doubted about anything in this program, in church, by my parents, by my teachers, by anybody who ever loved me, I understood that it was true. And it wasn't in doubt anymore. And I haven't had one of those days where I was like, since then, I've not had one of those days where I've had to doubt in that same way, where I've had to look around going, how am I going to defend against your lack of approbation? I really don't care what you think about me. I just want to tell the truth and be a child of God like you are, because you are all children of God, and I love you so much, and I wanted to be with you so bad, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. So, and then that's when I became one of you. And the steps just fell like dominoes. All that work, all those inventories, everything, it was all real and it was all okay. And so if you're in doubt and you don't have hope, I recommend that you pray for that. Because that one was answered immediately. Sometimes we have to wait. But I was disposed to just be naked before my creator at that point. Okay, so that's my experience with that. And what that's done for me is that about 10 seconds later, you know, all those women that were in my bed, you know, all that approbation that I was looking for, because that's really what I was looking for. It wasn't about sex. It was about, you know, getting this filled up with you. I was relying on human power with women. I was relying on human power with money. I was relying on human power with prestige, all the stuff that's of the world. But it had nothing to do with God. It had nothing to do with the power that's going to pull me back from the gates of death and keep me sober. About 10 seconds later, I'm in a hot argument with this woman at church. And we're both working with Caritas together. And I had my first pause moment. It says, pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. And God didn't seem to be answering my prayers on that for like the last 17 years. Because I had no filter. I was like Jack Nicholson in As Good As It Gets. He just says what's on his mind and he just blows people away like a freaking tornado emotionally. No friends, right? And that was me. So what was I like? I was that guy. A lot. Not all the time, but enough to, you know, I was lonely. And but I had a pause moment. I said, Laura, we can talk about this later, but right now I just want to get to my yoga class because I'm not feeling very yogic right now. I'm walking down the cathedral steps and she says, can I just ask you one more question? And we're both Irish, so we just want to get it in there. She said, "I don't know if you're in a relationship or anything. Would you like to go to dinner sometime?" And I'm thinking, we're just psychically at each other's throats. You're asking me on a date? My old sponsor, Paige, said, "No matter what it is you think you're looking for, just let God bring it to you." You know, I was always looking for the girl. I was always looking for the money, the power, the prestige, the approbation, all that stuff. And I was trying to manufacture that for myself rather than just doing the stuff and letting God just, you know, blah, 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 let the world handle it. And he said that, you know, when you find the woman that's supposed to be for you, she's just going to keep showing up like a bad penny. And that's exactly what happened. She just kept showing up. She's not a bad penny. She's a great woman, but she's not the woman that I would ever pick. You know, thank God. You know, and those of you who've met her know what a wonderful person she is. And she is other-centered, like I hope to be one day. Okay. She's all about serving her family. She's all about serving the babies down at the hospital. She's all about taking care of me. She's all about taking it. She never eats a bite of food until she makes sure that every child is like well ensconced into their meal. So I'm with somebody who really does make me a better man, even if I don't want to be. But I do want to be, and I've always wanted to be. I've always wanted to be free, and I never was until I came to you. And you were just consummately patient and gracious and kind in the face of my character defects for so long. And I just want to be able to pay that forward. It wasn't that I had a bad life before AA or a bad life since I've been in AA for 17 years. It's just that the heat's off now, and I recognize who's in charge. It only took 17 years. That's not so bad. I drank for 17 years. That's pretty quick. And in the course of human development, not so bad. I like watching shows on astronomy because it reminds me that we're a speck inside a speck. Isn't that great? I'm really not that important. You're going to forget this talk? You're not going to remember who the hell spoke last night, tomorrow? That's fine by me, you know? But I'll remember you because this is a great honor just to be able to be with you tonight, regardless of anything that I might say up here. I hope that it wasn't anything particularly bad taste. I always want to have the grace of God working through me. I begged for that when I was taking my last pee before I came out here. I really was, because I don't need to be up here cute and funny. I just want to tell you the truth. Oh my God, I went the whole time. I really wanted to, you know, I've always prayed to St. Ambrose because he could say in like one paragraph would have taken an entire treatise for somebody else. I love you guys, and I thank you so much for being here on a Sunday. One, not too long ago, this meeting did not exist, and we wouldn't have had the opportunity to be in fellowship with one another. We would have just died on 29, you know. Thank you very much.